like experiment and stuff, you know? Like we'd have an idea and we'd go into Liz Winstead and go, oh, we want to do this same thing. And she's like, all right, go ahead.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, as much as people drag Kilbourne for being, you know, this sort of frat boy or whatever.
Yeah, empty vessel, all that stuff. Yeah.
You know, that the show he shepherded had you and Frank DeCaro. And I remember Mike Blyden doing his weird sort of throw everything at the wall, music video reviews and shit. And it was this really, it was this kind of interesting, it was more like a news magazine than an actual parody of the news.
Right.
But again, there was nothing like it.
Yeah.
And it was crazy funny.
Yeah.
I think back very fondly on that. Man, long after you left, I tested for that in front of John and whew, did I shit the bed.
Oh, whew, really?
That was one of the worst. I auditioned pretty well too, but that was just
it meant too much to you, maybe.
It meant too much to me. And it meant too much to me, but it was also
hang on 1 second. Are we rolling?
That's fine.
Do you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
All right. I know that feeling, like, this is the one I want, and you...
But there was also, there was a certain ambivalence, too, because it was going to mean moving back to New York after I was just getting comfortable in L.A.
Yeah.
And, but I don't know how they, you know, when they auditioned people for the brand new Daily Show in 1996, I don't know how they ran it, but by the time it got around to, say, 2005...
Mm.
You ran a gauntlet and you showed up in a suit and you went out onto the stage and you auditioned in front of the green screen with John.
And something that you wrote, they wanted you to read.
They actually, they gave me copy.
Oh, okay.
And everybody I tested with read the same copy, which was interesting.
Oh.
And, I very specifically remember, I speak very quickly, naturally, because I'm from New York.
And by the way, this is John Ross Bowie, a great actor, comedic actor, currently in Speechless, and Emmy nominated.
Congratulations. Not quite. We're on a couple of lists, but the nominations come out in July.
I thought you were nominated as a comedy actor. Were you not yet?
No. I've been. There are a couple of those lists where, like, you know, who we'd like to see nominated.
Okay. All right. I jumped the gun.
No, it's fine. The bottom line is,
I'm nominating you right now.
I'll take it. I think that counts, right?
Yeah,
I think that's legit.
That's it. I have a lot of sway. So welcome to the show. But anyway, continue. We were just talking about the Daily Show, and he had nice to say that he remembered something I did on the Daily Show. But so they, and we were talking about his audition process, and you had to do the same sort of script, 2 minute script.
2 minute script, and this was so long ago that it was a fake remote in front of the Neverland Ranch.
Oh,
Michael Jackson
is
still alive, right?
Wow.
And so I do it, and I feel comfortable about the beats and the rhythm of it. And Stuart goes, okay, I want to do it again, only faster. And I say, okay. And then I hear all the writers in the audience, because they're all sitting there in the audience watching me. They all start laughing, and I realize, oh, I've already done it so quickly, and he's making fun of me.
Oh,
that's when the flop sweats kick in.
Oh, shit.
And so I've got the green screen thing to do and then a desk piece to do, and I'm sweating like Albert Brooks. I am just like projectile sweating. And it was one of those things where he was like, okay, well, nice adjustment. And I was like, yeah, don't patronize me, John. I just kind of slugged off back to Los Angeles, drank very heavily on the plane, landed on my feet. I had no complaints.
Oh, God, are you kidding?
But it was that was maybe one of the worst auditions I've ever had.
But, you know, it's intimidating. And when that show, you know, we were talking about Craig Kilborn a second ago, and I think you're right. Like, I don't think he gets a lot of credit for, he was really good. Like, we would write, like, some crazy shit. And he'd read, like, and some of it was, like, going after Hollywood, like, big time and people in Hollywood. He didn't give a shit. He'd read it, and I give Doug Herzog credit. Doug Herzog was the one that wanted him. He knew him from SportsCenter and liked his sort of dry, wry.
Well, that's the thing. He's got that great voice.
Yeah.
And he has a wonderful deadpan delivery that sounds, because he came out of conventional news.
Right.
He didn't come out of stand-up.
Right.
So he came in with this newscaster's aura.
Right.
And then when he'd get up and dance, it would sort of throw everything.
Right.
It would kind of give everything a tailspin. And yeah, I feel like history is not as cool to Craig Kilborn as they could be.
Yeah,
I mean, I know there was the whole thing with Liz Winstead and the whole and.
But no, listen. I mean, he was the guy in the chair for the 3.5-4 years, and then John came in obviously and made it unbelievable. But like, yeah, and we had already gotten critical success.
Oh, yeah.
Before we had the legions of fans, legions for cable anyway, and the 400. Yeah, you know, it was, not to sound whatever, but what's Hillary's thing? It Takes a Village. Like, everybody, Liz, Madeline Smithberg, they created the show. Other writers like Tom Johnson and Ray James, these guys just, they brought a collection of people together. A. Whitney Brown, remember A. Whitney Brown?
Oh, sure, sure.
So he was, he's very passive-aggressive guy. Like,
okay.
Even, like, he would fuck with you, like, off, as friends, but he'd always, like, mind fuck you, right?
All
so
right.
He would do these pieces, and he and Brian Unger were the ones that really, along with us, the writers, but they were the ones that really sort of made the stamp with those field pieces, which were...
They created the,
yeah, we
the
were
Daily
like, you know,
Show
this,
field
the,
piece.
Those, you know, 60-minute pieces could be so sort of, you know, self-important. It was like, let's take that down a little bit, right?
Yeah. Vance DeGeneres, too. You got to give it up for Vance DeGeneres.
Yeah,
used to do
yeah.
things where he would, like, enter a frame by climbing down a ladder
yeah.
or something. Just all these right. weird little tiny skews on the format.
Yeah, and he just, in his manner of speech, and just, it was perfect, right, for the, so Whitney would have a guy, like, in earlier on, we were, like, finding just oddball local people for a fair amount, right? But they were interesting. Like, there was a woman who, like, invented a new chastity belt, for her husband to lock his balls in his dick, right? And so, but
how do I not remember that?
And you know, in comedy, it only works if she's not in on the joke, and they're
of
not.
Course.
Like, they think this is a great idea, and the world should know. So... he gets with whoever the person is, and he'll go, so let's say, like, you're the mayor of a town, and you got some crazy idea. So, John, you know, people in town say you're creative, and you're thinking, and the guy will go, yes, and non, and avant-garde, yes, and on the edge, yeah, an idiot, a moron, a douchebag, and he'd keep going down, and the guy would just keep nodding, and then at some point you'd see the guy go, I'm getting insulted, and then he'd just stop and sit there, and he did it in such a... subtle passive-aggressive way. It was one of his go-tos. It was hilarious.
My friends who worked on the show said that they would do something that I find positively nefarious, but as the show began to grow in notoriety
yeah.
with Stewart starts in when, 99, 2000?
Yeah, 2000.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So as the show begins to grow in notoriety and the Emmys start showing up and stuff like that, they're still doing field pieces, but they cannot identify themselves as The Daily Show, so
right.
they would come out and go, we're from cable news.
Right.
And that was all it took for, yeah. like, you know, this racist sheriff to open his mouth,
right, exactly.
or, you know, that lunatic entrepreneur
right.
to,
right.
you know,
right.
to, you know, libel himself.
Right.
And it was just, it was, when it worked, God, it was just fascinating. And yeah, it took, it didn't just parody the news, it parodied the way the news is presented.
Yeah, well, it's funny, two quick stories. Brian Unger we were just that horseshit undercover stuff that they do when during sweeps, you know, local, like they go undercover
oh, right.
for the
yeah,
prostitution,
yeah.
whatever, and
yeah.
it was all just for sweeps.
What's in your meat?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And we went in with a thing in a bag. So this was a how to do an undercover piece, and it was around Christmas, and there were the, you know, in Times Square, there's the
Salvation Army.
The Salvation Army Santas.
Right.
And, you know, there's a guy, ding-a-ling-ing, Salvation Army, you know. And we're gonna see if this is actually a true Santa, or is this a scam? Is he a real? So he has a camera in a bag undercover, and he starts, like, taunting the Santa, like,
oh,
going, "You're not really with the Salvation Army. Hey, guy, get out of here! Like, hey, I'm serious, get out of here." He goes, "Hey, look, if you don't get the fuck out of here, I'm gonna fucking knock you out." And he said one more thing, and he took a swing at him, and on camera, and then we're like, we stopped it in freeze frame, and that's how you get your victim, right? And we stopped him in freeze frame, taking a Santa, taking a swing at Brian. It was just like,
that's glorious. As long as we're talking shit, I did a day on the Santa Claus 3 with Tim Allen.
Mm.
And so it's the third in the Santa Claus franchise.
Mm.
Tim Allen is contractually obligated to be there.
Mm.
Tim Allen does not want to be there.
Oh.
And apparently, now the day I was there, he was not in makeup. We were doing, like, a fantasy sequence. But apparently for the rest of the shoot, Tim Allen shows up at, like, 4:30 in the morning, does 3 hours of Santa makeup, and then emerges this incredibly irritable, vaguely right-wing comic dressed as Chris Kringle.
Right-wing.
And it just became this nightmare scenario where the whole everyone on the crew when I got there is like, I think we got good Tim today because bad Tim has been showing up all week.
So angry Santa.
Angry Santa is my favorite archetype.
Oh, that's great. The other thing that we did one time was this was the Disneyfication of Times Square. This is when Times Square was getting rid of the smut shops and all the, and so the Disney store was like the big thing.
That was
like
the flagship. Yeah, that was
because it was so antithetical to the sort of the what was there. So Brian goes in and explores what's really going on, and he goes, "Has anything really changed? I don't think so." And then he would turn around and he'd grab the most innocent, childlike stuff, like a mermaid doll, and go, "This is a dildo." And then he'd just start grabbing stuff and going, "Dildo, dildo, anal probe," like, right? So they cut the piece together. And then, like, this is when Doug was very involved and would, like, screen pieces every once in a while. And he went ape shit. And he saw it, and there was a meeting, and he goes, "You can't say dildo 13 times in a 4-minute field piece." And we're like, "Well, where's that rule come from?"
And right also, now? How many times can we say
dildo? Yeah, exactly.
Is it 11 and out?
Yeah. And now it's like, you know, when your dad yells at you, but he's mad, but he's sort of proud and he's half smiling, and you can't take him seriously, so you're trying not to laugh. It was that dynamic. And he goes, "Well, you can't." So we go, "All right, well, how many? How many times can you say it?" Right. So he goes, and his eyes are darting left and right, and he's searching, you know, and he's like, "Six! You could say it 6 times!" So we gave him a nickname, the Six Dildo Doug, after that. But he wanted us to go over the line and then pull us back, as opposed, you know, otherwise you're not going to be at that line. You're always going to be worried about it. So we would go too far sometimes, and, you know, we'd get our hands slapped, but it was all for the good, you know?
Well, again, it had to have felt like Deadwood, though, because there was nothing like it, and it was, you know, that's the idea of scripted programming on basic cable.
Yeah.
Comedy Central was the domain of reruns and South Park, and that's kind of it, right?
Yeah. They were doing you know, half-hour specials for comics.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
right?
Stuff like that.
But
short attention span theater, shit like that.
Right,
you know?
Right. Alan Havey had a talk show for a short time. But yeah, it was just like, it was crazy. You know, it was sort of like, how the hell did this happen? Like, and then I'm in the middle of it, you know, and it was like, and I really do think we would not have been able to be as experimental now with so much at stake. And, you know, Comedy Central was not owned by Viacom at the time and shareholders to account to and all other stuff, right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
It's sort of like, you know, Doug Herzog deserves a lot of credit too and doesn't get enough for that show because he didn't put an order limit. For those listening, an order limit is typically like, oh, a sitcom, they give him 13 episodes.
Right.
If it doesn't work out, it gets canceled. This didn't have an order limit because he understood that this was a new thing. There was no model for it. It was. We were stealing clips from news. We didn't have a budget news feeds and stuff. So we'd like just videotape something for CNN and then use it. And then they'd call in legal and complain. And then we'd go steal it from NBC. Or
you'd rather beg for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, it was crazy. But anyway, enough about that and more about you. Welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been fun geeking out and getting my personal oral history of The Daily Show.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Speechless, I want to talk about, but I want to get to. We have mutual friends in Rob Corddry.
Sure.
Naked Babies, partner of yours, and Brian Husky, who's been on the show too.
Okay.
Yeah. And
it was those two and Seth Morris and myself
and
were rounded
Seth too,
out.
Yeah. At UCB, after you had a stint as a copywriter.
Yes.
Right?
I did. I was a marketing copywriter for Price Waterhouse, and then I was there for the merger when they became Price Waterhouse Coopers.
I can't see you in a corporate setting, but that's
well,
really
nor could I, nor could anyone else. I let the record show that it wasn't one of those things where I thought the job was beneath me. I really tried to be good at it, and I just couldn't handle it. And
so, what were you copywriting for an accounting firm? Like, was it...
I was copywriting. I was writing stuff like brochures for potential clients. Like, oh, you're a utility company. Here's what we could offer you. Right, the brochure is called Potential Energy. See, that's something I wrote. That's my thing that I wrote.
Right.
But I also remember getting pushback because they were like, okay, so we have a wing of the consulting firm, John, and they've got, they're called the Change Integration Practice, and they need a newsletter so everybody in the East Coast will know what every other office is up to. And I submitted a format for the newsletter called Changes, and they were like, absolutely not. We don't. Why would you stutter? I'm like, I'm not. How am I the only person who knows Bowie in this room? This is crazy. Jesus, come on. And so it was a lot of that in my Pricewaterhouse years of me just not connecting with my coworkers.
You're in a different sort of plane.
And trying my best. Like I think this will be fun and interesting, and we can make this place fun and interesting. And they're like, yeah, we're a 150-year-old accounting firm, John. Maybe we know what we're doing and you don't. How about that? And you know, there comes a point where you have to go, you absolutely do. I apologize. And so I started taking classes at Upright Citizens Brigade. And
let me ask you this, though. Did you, in college, were you sort of, was the idea of performing of in any way, shape, or form in your, because it wasn't for me when I had a whole other
life.
You
went to law school,
I was
didn't
a
you?
Lawyer, and yeah. I was, and then this thing bit me in the ass, and I was like, I got to do it, or if I don't at least try, and doesn't work out, whatever, and then whatever. But like,
remarkably similar story. Yeah. I had deep down inside. I grew up right here in Midtown Manhattan, and I grew up right in the theater district, and I got to see. We didn't have a ton of money, but we'd find like ways to get half price tickets, and I saw a lot of theater, and I'd go to the movies a lot, and I loved the idea of acting, but I also knew so many people who were struggling. Because, you know, this wasn't an abstract for me. These were my neighbors were like desperately trying to get a U5 on a soap opera. You know, like these were my friends' dads who were crying because they didn't get an arc on Kate and Allie. That's a real story.
Wow. Really?
So you see, you don't just see the people on stage or the people on the screen. You see the people trying to make a day-to-day living.
Yeah.
And that'll scare you off if you're me.
Yeah. No, so, if you're anybody.
Yeah. So I tried. I looked around and tried to do anything else, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I studied to be a high school teacher. I did that for 1 year. That was exhausting.
At that point, though, in the deep recesses of your mind, if you were going to go into this business, were you thinking of yourself as a straight actor, a comedic actor, a comedian? Or
I saw myself as probably a comedic actor more than like a stand-up.
Because improv was not what it was when you got into it in terms of it was big at Second City, but there was no UCB at that time.
And well, there was. I was there at the one thing I've been on the ground floor of was UCB in New York.
Right.
We started in, Rob and I started taking class in May of 98. So that they had just opened a few. They actually didn't have their own space yet. They were renting space down in Chelsea. And we started taking classes. And I got up and did a scene, and I got a really cheap laugh with a really easy gay joke, but still was like, wow, I just got a laugh.
Yeah.
And I did that for a few more weeks. I was like, you know, I'm going to give notice at Pricewaterhouse. And I had a bunch of other stuff going on in my life where I was like, you know, I had a long-term relationship that was going south, and I was getting really, really depressed. And I sort of felt like, I think now might be the time to like, I'm 27. I'm still young enough that I can put a hand grenade under my life and kind of piece it back together, you know?
Yeah. Same exact thinking. Like if I don't seize this moment.
If I don't seize this moment, I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life.
And I'm dating and living with my girlfriend who we've been together since high school at that
same
point.
Same thing.
And I'm like, you know, we're planning, both want to get married, start a family. So it's like, and she was totally cool about whatever I wanted to do, but same.
Not the same thing. I begrudge her very little. I mean, what she saw was a guy who at 27 is like, I think I want to be an actor. And she's like, oh,
but then you
dude.
Go, but do you not understand? I couldn't sell changes to these guys at Deloitte. Do you understand the hell that I'm living in?
And
but by the way, I respect her for that, and I would have respected my wife if she reacted the same way, because it's a scary trip down who the fuck knows lane, right?
Oh, it's a who the fuck knows lane with a series of weird cul-de-sacs off it. And yeah, no, exactly. It's the geography is shaky.
Yeah.
And I very quietly, I quit Pricewaterhouse.
And your Pricewaterhouse was about 5 years at that point? 4 years?
Oh, no, only about full-time, about 2.5. I temped for a couple years before then.
And what was it about Pricewaterhouse and copywriting in particular that you thought, okay, that's kind of my path? Like, what was it because you're a good writer, English major?
I was an English major, yeah. And I like language, and I have a facility with it, I suppose. But I went and... I got just assigned there on a temp job, and you know, there were some creative aspects too. You know, there's a whole marketing department, and there were people who designed all the cool brochures and made the cool signs. And it was kind of interesting being around, like, yeah, the people who design the logo that is going to represent this 150-year-old firm. Right. You know, there is a coolness to being some part of something that is. Coolness is not the right word. There is something impressive about being part of something that's this
old. Especially at that age. It's heady. Yeah.
It's heady to be part of like this multinational thing. Mm. And I literally stumbled into the copywriting thing. Like, hey, John, you know, why don't you apply for this job? And you're just an administrative assistant right now. What if you applied to a job doing copywriting and you could go full time and you could get benefits?
Mm.
And you could get a company Diners Club card, which would be fucking crazy. So I did all of that and gave it close to 2 years. And when I submitted my resignation, I said I was going to pursue a career in acting and improv. And honestly, if it had not failed, if it had like failed miserably, I would have absolutely deserved it because I... You know, like the whole thing with my relationship went entirely south, and then I quit the job saying I'm going to go pursue a career in improv, which is adorable. But I gave myself this quiet deadline that, like, if I don't book a commercial within a year, then I will reassess and we'll figure it out.
That's kind of being tough on yourself, especially when you're starting. It's tough to book commercial because they tend to use the same people over and over again. And
here's the only thing I had going for me: at 27, I was a fresh face.
Yes.
You know, and a lot of the fresh faces are fresh out of college.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a little bit of, you know, I knew what it actually meant to.
So the guys that they were maybe casting as the young husband in a new marriage that they've been using the same 8 guys in New York now suddenly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing I had going for me is that I was rail thin. I weighed like 145 pounds, had glasses. Never had a decent haircut. And this was the rise of the .com era. So all the commercials needed nerds.
Yeah.
So I would go out like a fucking fashion model. I would go out like 5 or 6 times a week. And sure enough, like the very first commercial for a Sprint phone that you could access the internet on, I'm in that.
Wow.
I'm in that fucking commercial.
And that's like the big thing that you can access.
We thought
it was
ridiculous. We thought it was like, who's going to need this?
What is this?
Who's going to need it? Here we are sitting with these, you know, massive supercomputers in our pockets.
I've got to check it in 10 seconds.
In 1999, I did a commercial for Sprint. It was I did a clump of 3 commercials in a row and was a must join for the union and made my year deadline by about 2 months.
How'd you get your agent? That's the tough part.
That is the tough part. Agents were starting to recognize that UCB was becoming a bit of a breeding ground, and they came to see the Naked Babies in shows. And Paradigm's commercial department, which was run by this great guy named Doug Keston, picked up me and Cordry and started sending us out regularly. And again, I had that.
Right,
built in
the
nerd
type,
thing,
yeah.
You know. It was funny because I'd go out for these commercials where they're like, okay, they need the representative for this new .com, and he's got to be super, super nerdy. And I was like, okay, well, that's just who I am. So I would just show up, and other guys would show up with like the pocket protector and the tape on the glasses, and
it's like that scene in Seinfeld where they're casting the Seinfeld, and like all these guys try to come in to be Kramer, and then this guy comes in and he's like. He's just being himself, and he's totally Kramer, the guy who like steals the raisins. Yeah,
exactly. It was really interesting, and I think the casting directors, you know, they're trained to smell bullshit.
Yeah.
So these guys would come in with, you know, their pants rolled up, you know, mid shin and everything, like, you know,
hair askew.
Yeah, looking like Urkel, and I was like, okay, guys, less is more.
Yes,
pull it back just a little bit. And it was a little inappropriate, but at the time I called them Uncle Tom nerds.
That's
great.
Hilarious.
It's not great. That's a heinous bit of cultural appropriation. But I was just kind of like, guys, just let it happen.
Yeah.
For the love of God, duct tape on your horn rims. Must you? So it was a combination.
They probably actually broke. They're method actors, so they actually probably broke the glasses.
Then retaped them.
They had to really feel like that they broke the glasses.
Absolutely. That's part of the process. The it was a combination of you know, that sort of desperation that comes from with, like, I've tried everything else. Yeah. This is not working. I have to try this.
Yeah.
And incredibly good timing.
Did your girlfriend break up with you because you pursued that, or was
No. She checked
anyway.
Out my Netscape browser history, and that was the death knell. 1998, y'all. What?
That's Netscape browser history.
Yeah, it was pretty. It was pretty colorful.
All right, there you go. Not so much of a nerd there, are you?
I think there's nothing not nerdy about the the amount of 56K internet porn I was looking at, but. if you're out there, I won't name you, but sorry, we were having a rough patch. It was also a maelstrom of things. And she had certain aspects of her sexuality she needed to explore.
Oh, okay.
Less said
there
the better, but, but
she's here. Come on.
Oh
in.
My God. What are the odds?
This is your life. So UCB, what attracts you to that? And how do you come to work with these three great turn out to all be really successful in their own right, too? Like, how does that come together?
There was something about UCB where they were the first game in New York where they were doing long-form improv that was a little more patient and maybe a little more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And by extension, also a little slower paced. There's mm-hmm. people who really don't like long-form improv. And the kind of improv I had seen was short form, where it was just joke, 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 joke.
Mm.
And that terrified me. And that still kind of scares me.
Mm. Because you've got the pressure to come up with something, bang, bang,
really bang. Instantly, and nothing has time to breathe,
right?
And you also people tend to fall back on their bag of tricks really easily.
Yeah.
There's something about a genuine storytelling and a chance to let moments kind of happen in long form improv, and I remember seeing. Early ASCAT shows and seeing a group called The Swarm, who were the first big improv team out of UCB with guys like Andy Secunda, who's on the goal, who's a writer on the Goldbergs now, and all these great people.
I do the monology on that sometimes. I go down and do the
monologues for ASCAT? Yeah, sure.
It's really great.
It's great. Fun. Yeah, I've done the monologues. It's fantastic.
It's great to watch them work. It's incredible.
And what's great about the way they do that is someone comes up and tells a true story from their life, and then they do scenes based on that story, and the scenes kind of, you know, link together or they don't, and it kind of it's very loosely structured, and there is something about that free spiritedness that really appealed to me, and about the yes, it was ephemeral, but you could have these. Deeply funny moments than rather than just these. Oh, he made a
rather than
to
having
the Simpsons.
Yeah, rather than having 10 sort of somewhat shallow jokes, you have 4 really sort of beefy jokes
or comedic moments, or like almost set pieces that you could get, and that really attracted me. And I think my end game, whether I declared it to myself or not, was to be not, you know, not necessarily go to Saturday Night Live or anything like that, but to end up on a sitcom. So, you know.
Yeah.
Achievement unlocked for the
moment.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. But it was UCB was at the time, it was probably very much the way Daily Show was at the beginning. There were no real rules. Everybody was kind of flying by the seat of their pants. If you had a half-baked idea, they'd give you stage time.
That's great.
And the stakes were really low because there wasn't really a ton of work in New York at the time. Mm. You know, there was Law and Order, but there was only one Law and Order. Maybe you had an under 5 is like the bartender who maybe saw her come in that night,
right,
you know?
Exactly.
There were soap operas, but you needed perfect bone structure. I can't think of a sitcom that was shooting in New York, Spin City.
Yeah.
And I went out for Spin City a couple times and didn't book it. They would always ask you how tall you were. You didn't tower over Michael J. Fox.
Hilarious.
The first thing they go, hi, John. Thanks for coming in. How tall are you?
5'2".
I'm
lying.
I would say 5'8", and I would see the light just fall out of their eyes. So because of that, there were no, you know, there was no intense competition. It was just creative people.
But that's what you need.
It was an incredibly welcoming environment.
I perform in the city, right? And you perform at the Comedy Cellar, right?
Right.
There's like, you got to kind of kill every time you go there.
I'm sure.
You can't experiment a lot because they know, they find out, and then there's a thing, right?
Well, where like, do you go to fuck around? Where do you go to, like, try out brand new shit?
QED, I like, in Queens.
Oh, I've heard of that place. Yeah. It's in Astoria.
Yeah, it's really cool. I'll do, like, some bar shows.
Yeah.
Stand Up New York on the Upper West Side.
I did stand up there one time. It's, the handful of times I've done
stand
up. Yeah,
they're actually, like, you know, when you got to do your thing and it's a packed house on a weekend, you deliver, but, like,
Monday
I feel
night.
Really comfortable playing there, you know, and you need those safe spaces.
Yeah, of
Otherwise,
course.
Otherwise, you're just stuck with something on a piece of paper that you, and I tend to sort of, I improv myself, and I work best if I'm just talking it out. Like, I'll have an idea, and then I start talking it out, and I back myself into a corner on stage and hope something comes.
Yeah, you know who else works like that is another great Paul, is Paul F. Tompkins will work like that. He's great, and he'll do these things, and he's recorded them. They're on his albums. Before his quote-unquote prepared material, he'll just get up and riff, and same sort of thing. He will paint himself into a logic corner and then just somehow figure out a way to, like, crawl up the ceiling and get out of it. And it's dazzling to listen to. It's so fun.
Usually what I have to do is I tell a lot of stories from my life, and like, and if I get in an argument with somebody, and it's and I get in, I'm a real argument, I'll go home and start ranting to my wife, and 50% of it's already written because it's just coming out of my mouth,
right?
And then I'll later go, oh shit, I should write some of that down. My wife's like, anytime you get in a fight and come home and tell me, you should turn the recorder on your phone on so you have it already read. But so you need those places, and so it's like you're saying, like the Daily Show, like. When there's a lot at stake, these institutions, whether it's a theater or a television show or network, they get safe. And when you get safe, you get broad down the middle, pedestrian, or there's no experimentation, and then it's important, you know?
There was a huge outcry in the early aughts when a few groups splintered off from UCB and started their own theaters, like the People's Improv Theater and is the Magnet still open? A place called the Magnet. Mm. And these were splinter groups. And, you know, there was some, you know, there was some poaching of employees and stuff like that. And while, you know, that sucks, certainly, and I'm sure it felt like a betrayal for a lot of people, there came a point where UCB was the only game in town, and as such, and people were now getting picked from UCB to go on SNL. You know, Bobby Moynihan comes out of UCB. Mm. He's homegrown. Mm. The Daily Show people were coming out of, you know, that's where the Daily Show found not just Rob, but Ed Helms came out of a lot of UCB stuff. Mm-hmm. So when it becomes a real breeding ground for talent, it ceases to be a breeding ground for, you know, incredibly dangerous exploration and incredible failure. It's and I'm not knocking UCB. They still take incredible chances, but there needs to be an underdog, you know?
Yeah, it's funny because I just had this great director, Don Scardino, on.
Sure.
And
he did a bunch of 30 Rocks, right?
Yeah. And the Incredible Wonderstone. And he was an actor. He was a soap actor. In this studio in the 60s. He got his Equity card at 14.
Oh my God.
He was like a young star. He did Jesus Christ, he did Godspell, played Jesus, over a thousand performances in Canada and New York.
Oh my God. Was he in that crazy cast in Toronto with like Gilda Radner?
Yes.
No shit.
Yes.
Wow.
This was before SCTV. Gilda Radner, Eugene Levy, Martin Short.
Yeah.
Apparently he said Short and Levy would like do, like they were essentially like a comedy duo. They were hilarious. Dave Thomas.
Yeah.
All before they became SCTV people and whatever.
This is like a famous comedy nerd Godspell cast.
Yeah.
I've heard of this. There's pictures of Eugene Levy as Jesus.
Yeah.
With the big ass and everything. And it's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
It's like a glimpse into an alternate reality or something. And they just... That was the breeding ground for SCTV. Yeah, they just, you got to see this part. This Godspell cast is amazing. You got to see these guys.
That's exactly what's going on. And so Don then was on The Guiding Light on a soap opera for 2 years, and he got offered the part to play one of the monkeys on TV and couldn't take it because of his contract, because he was locked in.
Oh, my God.
But he goes, you know, it was better because, you know, Mickey Dolenz is still trying to be considered as a serious actor. Like, you know, once you get stuck in that thing, right?
Yeah.
So, but what he was saying is he went to the School of Performing Arts in high school. And then when he started working and getting legitimate work, they wouldn't let him be in school anymore because you could only be there if you weren't working professionally. And it was like, well, how does a guy can grow artistically if you don't give him this space? It was so bizarre to me.
And that's why they started the Professional Children's School, which is a few blocks from where we're sitting right now, just near Lincoln Center. Mm. And that's for literally working child actors who like need Wednesdays afternoons off because they're the kid in Les Mis or the kid in Miss Saigon.
Yeah.
And it was an actual reaction to places like, it's now called LaGuardia, the performing arts school. But it was like, what if these kids are, you know, actual taxpayers and we need to like work around their work schedule, but they still want a high school diploma. And it's like where Macaulay Culkin went. It's fascinating. It's just a few blocks from here.
Yeah, it's important. And like, it's great that UCB created. I think it's still a place like that for people.
Oh,
right?
It's still a place where you can take chances, certainly. I just think that, people start getting success from that place. And I owe so much to UCB. I got my agent and my first agent and my first manager, who's still my manager, saw me in stuff at UCB and were like, okay, yeah, we'll work with this guy. So my debt to them is, you know, untellable, but, because of that, I think people are afraid to fail there and afraid to like, here's the thing. I don't think they do this anymore, but in the LA theater, they used to do a thing called the drug cage match where they would have three teams doing competitive improv. One team was drunk, one team was stoned, one team was on shrooms. They don't do that anymore. 'Cause you know, that's against the law, even in California. But Shroom's team would always win because they were, you know, working under such a hindrance, you know, because like they didn't like they, you know, they could, they were listening to their hands, you know, it was all they could do to like string a sentence together.
Shh, my index finger is telling me something.
Oh my God, this is so interesting. I wish you could hear this, you know. And I remember talking to people after this great guy, Drew DeFonso Marks. I remember talking to Drew one time after he did the Shroom team at the drug cage match. And he was like, I spent the whole show thinking I was on my couch at home thinking about what the show would be like, which is funny no matter what. But if you've ever tried hallucinogens, it's amazing. I mean, that's like a William S. Burroughs essay or something.
That's hilarious.
So, yeah, they can't do that anymore because there's agents coming. Agents don't want to sit through you tripping your fucking balls off.
And then try to have a conversation with you afterwards.
Yeah, we're not going
to
schmooze you.
Stop
while
facing
you're
the wall while I talk to you. Will you please get out of the fetal position? I'm trying to sign you.
That's fantastic that you can taste music. What are your aspirations?
Oh my God, that's hilarious. Did you find, I mean, the work that you've done and the stuff that you've been in, The Heat, He's Just Not That Into You, you said Santa Claus 3, Reno 911, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Reno 911, Fresh Off the Boat, Psych. My son loves Psych.
Yeah, Psych has a fascinating, devoted fan base.
He and my wife, they cannot get enough of it. And I think it's good, but I'm rarely like that with stuff other, like maybe Curb Your Enthusiasm, but they love it.
Well, it's
how was that working on that?
What was interesting about Psych was I had actually tested for the part that Dule Hill got, and so I got the role of a suspect in first season as sort of a consolation prize, which is sometimes how Hollywood works.
Yeah.
As cruel as the town can be, they throw you a bone now and again.
Yeah. But it's in front of you every day that you're not the guy that's
constantly. So, but
torture.
But you know, no regrets. Everything worked out. It would have meant moving to Vancouver. But what's interesting about Psych and why people love it and keep going back to it is that it was packed with weird little esoteric references and in jokes
almost
all over
like
the place.
It's almost like a live action Family Guy.
Yes, very much so. With weird little throwaway jokes. I remember one exchange on an episode one time where Sean and Gus are going through something and Gus just throws away. He goes, I plead the fifth. And Sean goes, plead the fifth what? Amendment? Dimension? Beetle? And Gus goes, you can't plead Billy Preston. I was like, oh my God, what millennial is enjoying that joke? What millennial is enjoying the joke about the fifth Beetle? But there it is.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, you can almost refer to the show as a text because it's so dense with all these other little point over here and these cute little anachronisms and references. Yeah. So people go back to that show a lot.
Yeah, no, they love it. Did you find, and then, you know, you've been on, Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
And that is sort of your more traditional sitcom. And you, I know you kind of came out of sort of some of the more quirky stuff, if you will. Did you find just generally with your improv skills, once you started getting these regular parts, especially on the sitcoms, was there a big adjustment for you? Because now you're working script a lot. I imagine they don't give you a lot of takes off script, you know, kind of let you run.
No, they don't. You're not. Improv is certainly on tape night. It is frowned upon. You know, if you find something in rehearsal during the week, is the nice thing about multicam sitcom is that you rehearse it like a play.
Yeah.
And you have 4 days to rehearse and then you shoot on the fifth night. And, you know, they have got it polished and down to a certain amount of time. Mm. So there's, in one way, it's incredibly different because, like, read this stuff as written.
Right.
You know, if that is we are, then they mean we are.
And,
they don't
and by the
were.
Way, the we, because Don and I, Scardino, were talking about this. He's a director, but the people with, he's got power, but the people on that set are the showrunner writers who run the writer's room, and they'll come over to you and say, you got to say that again, and you got to emphasize the R. Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. It's
psychologically,
a writer's
that's kind of in the back of your mind, right?
Absolutely.
You don't have that on a film. You have the director to focus on, not the writer of the screenplay, but so that had to be an adjustment, right?
It was an adjustment, but the nice thing that was very much a visit from old home is working in front of an audience again.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of the sketch comedy I would do with Naked Babies was actually meticulously scripted, and we got things down to a certain, like, this joke works this way.
Yeah.
If you fuck with it, it won't work. We've seen it happen.
Yeah.
So we've got this down to, like, a nice little... It works if it's delivered this way with the emphasis on fire and not this word, and that's
right.
What you're going to do. So it's still fun to – I always call it multicam sitcom sort of theater with a safety net, because you're up there, you're doing it in front of an audience, you've got live laughter telling you when you're nailing it,
yeah.
And then if you screw up, they're actually secretly thrilled because they've just seen a blooper.
Yeah.
And who doesn't like
that.
A blooper?
And then they'll laugh harder the second time because
when you
they
nail
want
it.
They want to help and they want to help you.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And it's a really exciting feeling getting up in front of that. And especially the Big Bang Theory, because those audiences are so psyched to be there. I mean, they're not like those audiences that they pay to bus in from Covina. I mean, these people want to be at a
Big
Bang Theory.
Having
taping.
You on there and then the other guy, what a cast of did they up your game? Are you up each other's game? Like, do you find that there's a
there's no excuse for not knowing your stuff when you watch Jim Parsons' work, because he is given mountains of dialogue, and a lot of it is dense scientific stuff that he himself does not understand. I mean, that guy's got a master's in theater, not physics. And I was talking to him about all the jargon, because there's a page on the front of every Big Bang Theory script of unfamiliar terms and how they're pronounced. Okay.
Wow.
You don't.
Every script
has a couple words that aren't in the common nomenclature, and you can't expect, a bunch of actors to understand. I can't obviously think of a single one right now because I was an English major, but the
battery.
No, it wasn't battery. No, it's a little harder than battery. Batterai? No. So you watch Jim work, and you watch him just walking around set when he's not actually shooting with index cards with the other person's line on the front and his line on the back, just drilling himself like he's getting ready for the SATs. And he is learning so much of his stuff. He always jokes that he's like ABBA, in that he's just learning this phonetically. You know, the way they learn their English lyrics, he's just learning this, you know,
so he's
Waterloo, Waterloo. He just doesn't know what he's saying. And
Waterloo.
It's just...
Picture of a guy named Lou.
Yeah. He doesn't have the first idea what he's saying, but he sells it so well.
So he's got his cue line on the other side, which is the actor's line that's going to cue this line with that word.
And that's how he studies.
Wow.
And they have a Wednesday to Tuesday work week, so he has Saturday and Sunday off to just really go in and just study his ass off. And, you know, if anyone, it's debatable whether anyone deserves that kind of money for working in television, but... He really works hard. He really does work hard.
And he's so facile with it. It just sort of rolls off his tongue.
Yeah, he makes it really sound like he knows what he's talking about. He's incredible. They all do, really, but he's just got, you know, the nature of that character is such that he's really got to sound like the authority all the time.
When you did Naked Babies, like, how were the how did you work? It's almost like a band, right? So everybody kind of has their role that they naturally sort of fall into. How did you come to decide to work together, the four of you, and what did you each bring to it? And what was your process when you were writing sketches? Were you all generating ideas and then sort of fleshing them out together, or writing in pairs?
As far as getting started, it started the way I think most sketch comedy groups start, which was, that guy's funny, I want to be near him. He will make me funnier. And the whole thing about an improv class is that...
So there's no jealousy. There's more like, hey, I want to go see that. I want to be near the sun. And
look, there's always jealousy.
Yeah.
Look, there's always jealousy.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's not. You can keep your little Pollyanna views of there's always jealousy.
Oh, no, we never.
No, yeah. My God, the love was nonstop. A rising tide lifts all boats. Hiss. But there was still a sense of these guys are really funny. Like, and I've just left. I'm the funniest person at Pricewaterhouse. Great. Terrific. Now I got to really step up now. Now it's not enough to be the funniest person at Pricewaterhouse.
I'm crushing it at the lunchroom at Pricewaterhouse.
I'm killing it at the corporate cafeteria. Oh, my God. You should hear me at the copy machine. I did a tight five the other day. So, no, we've really got to step up. And I think what was interesting, and we didn't do this deliberately, but we Brian, Seth, Rob and I were drawn together, and then it took my wife, who was around the scene at the time. Jamie Denbo.
Jamie, I'm sorry.
She pointed out that, you know, in me you've got a fairly stereotypical neurotic New Yorker. In Rob, you've got the boisterous masshole. In Seth, you've got the Northern California hippie who at one point biked across the country to get to New York. And in Brian from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He came out of the music scene in Chapel Hill. I can't remember what town he's from in North Carolina. Winston?
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, in him, you've got this like kind of strange Southern Gothic weirdo.
There's a guy like, oh, he's got bodies in his basement. That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, exactly. There is a wonderful, like, sinister quality.
Yeah.
And you know, now his steady gig right now is playing a guy who was abducted by aliens, and it's just game, set, match,
yeah.
Man. That's a casting coup.
We did a,
they are lucky to have Husky.
We did a commercial together, and they let us improvise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was LG had this new phone thing. And it was like you can swap out batteries, something the battery's rechargeable, whatever, and something with the battery. So, and he plays a therapist, and I play a guy that's just completely falling apart whenever my battery is low.
Okay.
So, and we try to work through it, and they just were like, they gave us script, and then we're like, can we just, and they're like, yeah, and then... They said they had so much that they could have cut like 10 commercials. It was so much fun.
I'm sure they had like 20 hours of perfectly usable footage.
It was
like
so fun. He's
no,
so great.
Husky's a terrific improviser. Yeah. And but so I think we all, like, without realizing it, we all fit these sort of archetypes that you don't usually see together.
Yeah.
And then the writing process, very little of it came from improv. A lot of it was just, I have this half-baked idea. Should I go write it? And the other guys would be like, yeah, there might be something there. Go write that.
So it was your idea. You would write the initial script and then sort of pass it around, and you start to sort of break it down.
We'd put it on its feet, and people would, and that's when the improv would kick in, and people would pitch new jokes. And I remember I got into this really weird rut where everything I did, and you see this happen on SNL sometimes too, but everything I did was a talk show parody, because that way someone could just ask questions, the other person could say funny things, and it was really lazy. It's a lazy way to write sketches, but I got into this real rut, and one of them called me out on it. I honestly don't remember who it was, and I was just like, oh, shit. Yeah, I got to stop doing that. Okay, fair enough. All right, we'll try something else. Thank you for that. So there was a lot of... You know, there was some ego bruising, certainly, like, why isn't this sketch working?
Yeah.
But we also, I remember one very specific story where we had this sketch where it ended with the three of them beating me up and kicking me down on the floor. And they were all very, very careful and responsible. And, you know, Rob had actually taken stage combat, so he was very careful that no one actually got injured. And the bit was that... everyone's kicking me, and then Rob runs in and goes, guys, they're giving out kittens down the street. And the two guys go, kittens, kick me, and run off. No, we think that's funny. You and I think that's funny. The juxtaposition of this abuse with these guys who want free kittens. Yeah. It fucking bombed.
What?
Every single... So we did it like three nights.
Was it like, oh, because they were thinking they were going to go beat up kittens or
something? Maybe that was it. Maybe that was the problem. We couldn't figure it out, and it became this password. Like, anytime we weren't sure about a sketch, we're like, is this Kittens Mach 2? Are we... Are we falling into the kitten trap again?
Where
incredibly funny people agree on something. This is funny. And then the audience is like, no, you guys are mistaken. That is not funny. You have blown it. I think that's a very common
thing. I have this thing where I've been lately doing it to say, I just blurred out, the Last Supper had to be tense. Right? Like,
I think that's great.
Right? So and they kind of go, oh, and I think it's maybe because now you're making fun of a guy who gets crucified, whatever. But I'm not. I'm just saying, like,
Really,
I tend to, you know, you're a big table. What are you going to chit-chat about? Like, you know what's happening.
Anytime someone knows something that the rest of the table doesn't know, that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
I back you up on
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
But it's bombing? It's not going well?
Well, no. That goes okay, and then they come along, and then I go, okay, so the meal's over. Who pays? Well, you let him, he's the boss. Let him pay. And he goes, besides, you're never going to see him again. And then I go, aha! And then 3 days later, you run into him on the street, and it's like, oh, Jesus Christ, I wanted to pay. And I think it's really funny. And that part of it where he's on the street, and then I go, that's where the phrase Jesus Christ came from in that context. And it fucking lays there 9 out of 10 times. And I'm going to do it until I die. I don't care because it makes me laugh. And I think it all works logically within the bit. Like, you run into him, you think he's... I don't know if it's because, oh, it's Jesus and he's been crucified. I don't know what it is. It drives me crazy.
It's funny. That's... I think... If it were me,
thank you for laughing at that. By the way, it means a lot.
I'm not mocking you. It's a sincere laugh. I think it's a really funny bit. What I'm a fan of sometimes is when stand-ups, because again, I've done stand-up, you know, just a few times and here and there, and I wasn't terrible, but it was clear that like I was only ever going to get to a high level of mediocrity, you know, and like we're set on mediocre white comedians. We're set. We have got, especially in LA, we are at a market surplus. So I was like, you know, there's people who are better at this. But I see a lot of it, actually. Yeah. And LA is a terrific stand-up town because there's all these people in their cars writing amazing stuff and by themselves constantly.
Yeah.
But what I like is when a guy has a bit that he knows is going to tank and then turns on the audience or like really belabors it and like goes, no, here's why that's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a fan of that kind of recovery. Yeah. That always makes me laugh.
Well, I do that. I just talk it out. The other night I just went, okay, that part of the joke I really like. Tell me what's wrong with it. And I literally opened it up to the floor. And
why not, you know?
I saw a rat running with a huge orange in its mouth, literally like running across Broadway. And I thought... Being in New York, all I could think is, well, good for him. He's eating healthy. You know? And then I was, and I got
fiber, vitamin C.
Right. And I'm searching for lines after that. And I've been trying every fucking thing. And then one night at Stand Up New York, I sat down on the stool. I go, all right, give me some lines. Tell me what you think. And, you know, sometimes somebody will give you a line and it's actually not bad, you know?
Yeah, sure, sure.
And so every once in a while, I'll do that. I turn into a workshop, you know?
As long as we're talking about this, I never talk about the times I did stand up, but I had a bit in my stand up about, it was based on a true story about my therapist getting a tattoo. My therapist got a tattoo that, which is what you don't need in a therapist. You just don't need your therapist to be badass.
You don't need in a therapist.
It's not a thing you need. It's your therapist to have ink. No one gains from that. But it was very subtle. It was the Buddha's eyes on his forearm right here. I'm touching the not hairy part of my forearm. And I had a couple of ideas of like worst tattoos for your therapist to have, you know, a teardrop, obviously. It's your fault across your forehead. But then I opened it up to the floor one time. I was in a deli in Beverly Hills doing stand up with, and there were some good people too, like Rob Delaney was on the bill and April Richardson, some really funny people. And I was like, fuck it, I'll open it up to the floor. And I can't remember who suggested Calvin pissing on you. I was like, yeah, that's a terrible therapist tattoo right there.
Oh, my God.
I think there's
awesome.
A lot to, like, because you take away their heckling power if you open up the floor.
Yeah, and it also breaks it down and it stops becoming a presentation of a show and it just becomes this real conversation, which I actually like and try to do a fair amount of.
There's a lot of ways to engage an audience.
Yes, yeah.
And that's a perfectly valid way to do so. And even though I don't do stand-up, I think about stuff like that a lot. There's a lot of interesting ways to, like, give the audience a sense of ownership and participation that isn't necessarily, why don't you come up here and tell me what you do for a living,
yeah,
which
exactly.
is, you know, nightmarish.
Yeah.
I won't wish that on anyone.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But I think that's a terrific way to approach. Just yeah. hash it out.
It's like, I'm determined, man.
We're going to get to the bottom of this.
And then I always, my fallback is I left being a lawyer on Wall Street for this. I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want. I've already paid my dues, so I'm going to say.
But I was on the partner track. Fuck you.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, this Jesus Christ thing is fucking good. I'm sorry. I probably will never get to do it on TV because they're so safe. But, oh, God. Speechless. How? That's like, it's rare. I feel like that's sort of a fairly groundbreaking show in some ways in terms of focusing on cerebral palsy. It comes...
Well, focusing on disability through a lens of comedy
yeah.
is something we haven't seen before.
Especially in, at that level of network, like, you know, like it must be when you got to audition for it, did you sort of get the sense like this thing could, if it's cast right, this thing could really be special?
Exactly. I thought I thought two things. I thought this, first off, I was like, oh boy, I've got an audition. Oh man, that's awesome. Oh, God, it's been a dead pilot season. I can't wait. Oh, this would be great. I'd love to get this job,
you know,
any job.
My agents were saying, like, if you're Latino, it was like gangbusters. But the white guys, seriously, they said to me, like, I don't know. Like, I don't, you know.
You know, the good news is I can be stopped by a cop without incident. So, I mean, I have my privileges, no question. But, yeah, I'm told that it's a little harder for white guys in the casting pool right now. But I looked at the subject matter and the pedigree of the writers, and I thought, well, you know, this could be disastrous. This really could be treacly and sentimental, and, you know, the dad could be the kind of character who sits his son down and goes, well, I guess that mean old Mr. McGillicuddy's disabled in his own way, son, you know, whatever, you know, some nightmarish after-school special scenario like that. But if it's good, there will be nothing like it on TV.
And how do you define good for you in that context as you're trying to figure out your character for the audition and all of that?
I define good by just playing as honestly as possible. But the other thing that our producer, Scott Silveri, who's totally worth a Google, and he's done some, he worked on Friends for years and years, but he did that really good show with Matthew Perry a few years ago called Go On, which was about a sportscaster
yeah.
whose wife dies.
Yeah.
That's a Scott Silveri show.
Oh, yeah, that was
only
a good
lasted
show.
For one season, but
yeah.
it was interesting,
yeah.
right? It was a single camera that, you know, obviously took a very serious topic and found, like, you know, what's funny about the grieving process.
Yeah.
And Seth actually was on the show playing an Iraq war veteran, I want to say.
Oh, you're right. I forget
yeah,
about that.
With like some PTSD
yeah.
issues. And Scott Silveri has this way of finding the funny in places where it usually isn't. But he set down two, you know, no man's lands when he was writing. He didn't want the show to be sentimental. And he didn't want the show to be cynical. So there's a world where this show is a Lifetime movie. And there's also a world where the show is an episode of South Park.
Mm-hmm.
And we're either doing neither or we're doing a little of both. And the combination is new. I honestly don't know what the formula is just yet.
What I like about it is it just treats the people with disability like people.
Well, sometimes they're assholes.
Yeah. And you drop the with disabilities and they want that. Whenever I see somebody in a wheelchair, not someone who broke their ankle in a wheelchair, but somebody with MS or whatever,
yeah.
I immediately talk to them from the stage because a lot of people want to avert their eyes.
Yeah.
They don't want to deal with it. They don't want to deal with it emotionally. They don't want to deal with it visually. There was a guy, I was headlining a club and he's MS like a motherfucker, like tube in his neck, like
really,
yeah, like
can he speak?
Yeah, but not well. Like he's pretty far along with three buddies, and I look at him. I go, well, this is just a guy out with his buddies on a Friday night,
right?
So I go to the guy in the wheelchair. I go, what do you got? He goes, what do you mean? I go, well, why are you in a wheelchair? What do you got? And he looked, and then you could hear the whole audience like go, don't talk to him.
Yeah, we're doing such a good job ignoring him.
Yeah. He goes, I got MS. I go, oh, all right, yeah. I go, you with your buddies, huh? I go, yeah, we're just hanging out. I go, you want to do a shot? He goes, fuck yeah. Place goes crazy, right?
Yeah.
I go, we get the shot. I go, now don't spill it because you got MS. Don't pull that shit on me. That's expensive. I'm paying for that. Place fucking going crazy. So then I go to the guy. He had a shawl on because I guess your system gets cold.
Yeah.
But the shawl was ratty and it had a hole like maybe the size of a small, I don't know, small ball down by one corner of it. And I go, what's going on with your shawl? He goes, what? I go, it's a piece of shit. I go, you got a hole in it. I go, let me guess. he had front wheels and back wheels. And I go, the front wheel caught the shawl and it cut a hole. He goes, absolutely. How did you know? I said to his friends, you cheap motherfuckers. You can't get $50 together and go to Marshall's and buy him a shawl. So I had a guy in the front with cowboy boots on. I go, take your boot off. He goes, what? I go, take your boot off. And I walked around the showroom and I had people put money in the boot. And then I dumped it on the guy who had MS.
Oh, my God.
He came back after the show. It was like, and I'm not patting myself on the back. His friends were like, nobody ever talks to this guy like that. This guy's come back three times to see me. And that's what this show, I think, can do. And I'm really excited that it's out there.
That's exactly it, I think. It's the idea of, we did an episode about a term that I had not heard before this year called inspiration porn, which is where able-bodied people like you and I look at disabled people and go, oh, my God, what an inspiration. What a hero that guy is. And he's like, you know what? I'm actually – most of us are just people, and, you know, we're pissy and irritable, and, you know, we're not all Stephen Hawking. Some of us
He puts everything in perspective. Yeah.
Exactly, you know, and they tied it into Cedric Yarbrough's character, Kenneth, and he's like, oh, this is like the magical Negro. And so that was our A line and our B line were these two topics that – are a little touchy, you know. Yeah. Disability and race going headfirst into that is a lot for 8:30 on a Wednesday night.
Yeah, exactly.
But I was so proud of the show, and the tag of that episode is really funny. I won't give it away, but it was something I'd never seen before. And the last time, you know, it's weird. The last time an ABC show had somebody with a disability on it as a series regular is probably Life Goes On.
Yeah.
With Chris Burke, and that's the early 90s.
Yeah.
So that's 25 years ago now.
I thought you were going to say Last Man Standing, but...
I have no comment on Tim Allen's cognitive abilities.
So when you are acting in this, you're dealing with sensitive material and you're dealing with people with disabilities. Did you find yourself having to be conscious of not getting out of what you normally do? Were you sort of changing the way you were approaching things? Were you acting, your method of acting any different than...
Method of acting isn't different because you're still listening and paying attention and looking at someone and trying to react honestly. And, you know, the way he communicates on the show is he looks at his board with a little laser pointer and you read off of the board whoever's in the scene with him. And he can speak in real life, but the character is nonverbal. In my day-to-day life, look, I'm not proud of this, but there was a time when I was remarkably free with the word retard.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, kind of knew it was inappropriate, but kind of didn't care.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't look back fondly on that anymore, even though, you know, JJ, the character, and Micah, the actor, are cognitively typical.
Mm.
It's a blanket term that is hurled at the disability community constantly and is used so casually.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look back now on my very casual use of the word, and I feel a little gross about it, I have to tell you. And maybe this is my public apology here, but...
Well, you know, I don't think you need one. It's just like sort of the culture was not... And I'm not sort of giving you an out either. It's just, it is what it is. Like, there were times when I used it too, and I don't anymore. And it's sort of like, it was the culture. Like, it was like faggot too. It was like
absolutely. Same thing, which is also a word that came kind of freely out of my... And, you know, I know gay people who use the word faggot, and, you know, it's theirs to use, you know.
But it's sort of like, to me, the way black people use the N-word with each other.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, when that whole shitstorm happened with Marr a couple weeks ago, and the following week he had Ice Cube on.
Yeah.
And who was, you know, to his credit, if you're going to have someone call you out on the carpet for using the N-word, good for you to make an Ice Cube. Okay.
Ballsy,
But Cube's point was, that's not your word anymore.
Yeah.
That's it. It's over. You don't get to use it anymore. Yeah. You had a good 400-year run with that word. We're taking it back now. Hope you enjoyed it. Yeah. That's absolutely off limits.
You really drove that car into the ground.
Yeah, you really. This is why we can't have nice things, Bill Maher. And so there is a heightened sensitivity. And like I was checking into my hotel yesterday, and they had a ramp. A temporary ramp up the middle stairs, but then you get to the top of the stairs and there's maybe a foot before the door, which is a manual door. And I'm like, this is fake accessibility. If I'm in a chair, if I get up to the top of the stairs, there's no way I open the door without rolling backwards.
Right.
this is not crossing my mind 16 months ago.
Yeah.
This is the furthest thing from my mind 16 months ago.
So the show's having a positive effect, not just on you, I'm sure people watching it, because...
I hope so, because it's been incredibly eye-opening to me. Like, I don't enter a space anymore without thinking, how does Micah get in and out of here? Hmm. And, you know, and then think of what our location scouts have to do.
Oh, God, right.
You know, our location scouts go out off the set. You know, we have a specifically designed apartment set. But you go off set and, like, there's door width is a thing that is an issue on our show that is not.
I didn't even think of that.
Of course. Why would you?
Yeah.
So, you know, there is this heightened awareness that I've had, which is not a bad thing. And they have used it for a lot of, they found a lot of comedic gold in there. You know, there's a great episode where they have a bonfire down on the beach, but it's really hard to get a wheelchair down on the beach. So, you know, when the mom protests, the bonfire gets canceled, and now there's a backlash, and all the kids are asking themselves, like, well, if we want to treat him as an equal, we then have to hate him sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And it became this incredible sort of oil spring of funny.
And it's also freeing to know that you can treat them like it's, you know, there's that scene in Seinfeld where this is the time when George is dating the woman who died. What was the character?
Susan. Yeah.
And they're at the apartment. This is actually the episode where the father was having his affair with John Cheever.
Yeah, yeah, yes, of course. So, oh my God, the John Cheever episode.
Yeah, the aunt or the sister is in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And the mother goes, "Did you wipe your wheels?" And she goes, "You know, it's just common courtesy. You come into the apartment, you wipe your wheels."
Oh, wow.
And it's like,
I haven't thought about that in years.
And it's exactly the idea to me of, like, and I just thought of it talking about it, like, you'd say that to a person just with shoes on.
They're going to track something
into
the goddamn house.
Whoever wrote that, Larry or Jerry or whoever the writers were with that, just said, we're going to just treat this fucking person like a person, except they got wheels instead of feet.
The Curb we did, my wife and I did Curb together, and the episode begins with us running into Larry on the street, and we have an Asian daughter in a stroller.
Mm.
And he immediately asks if maybe the little girl has a proclivity with chopsticks. and you know, it didn't bother me, because the funny comes from, what a fucking stupid thing to say. She's an infant we've adopted.
Right.
And I very remember specifically using a line that Jeff Garland was like, yeah, don't cut that, which was, you're Jewish. Are you automatically a great accountant? And they were like, no, don't use that. I was like, all right, you're lost, but okay.
Why would they cut that?
I don't know. It was weird. Either way, so we get really annoyed with him, and we disinvite him to something. But then later on, we run into him, and he's got a girlfriend with him who's using a wheelchair. And we think, well, how bad can he be if he's got a girlfriend in a wheelchair? So we re-invite him.
Yeah.
And then he shows up at the party with a different girl in a wheelchair. And it... different girl using a wheelchair. And I think back on that now a lot, obviously, because this was, God, 9 years ago that my wife and I did this episode. And it's still the same kind of principle. It's people, it's an inspiration porn thing. Like, why are we automatically assume that this character, Larry David, who's ghastly, why do we assume he's okay just because he would deign to be with a woman who uses a wheelchair?
Why does everything get wiped away because,
And it's in that one episode we dealt with a lot of stuff that we've gone deeper on Speechless.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, well, the show is in its second season.
We're heading into our second season. Yeah.
And you're going to get an Emmy. I'm saying
you
it
called
right
it,
here.
Man. You called it.
I control show business, so a phone call will be made after this.
Voting has closed, but what my aspiration this year is, I think this is Donald Glover's year. I don't think I'm gonna get nominated, but I think I might make a couple of those, like, internet filler articles, like who we would have liked to have seen nominated.
There you go.
And I'll take that.
All
that's
right,
fine.
There you go.
That's a place I wouldn't have been 14 months ago. I'll take it. Sure.
Print it out. Show your kids.
Yeah.
real quick. The idea of working on Curb Your Enthusiasm, dream of mine. What was it like? I know you get a structure of a scene and you kind of improvise it with Larry, and that's it, huh?
You get a paragraph.
And does he make it a comfortable set to
Fuck
work?
No,
in? No.
Is
he up your ass? Like, if
he's not up your ass. On the contrary, he. You know, there's not a lot of chit-chat between sets, between scenes.
Oh, so that's why it's not very comfortable. It's kind of very all business, and
It's interesting. it is a fun audition because you go in with just a paragraph, you play with Larry, and Jeff is watching. And my wife and I were called in together because that's kind of a, you know, we did a lot of Reno 911s together. We met in an improv class. It's kind of our shtick to a certain extent. And so we go in and you get this paragraph, like you run into Larry on the street. He wonders if your daughter, your Asian adopted daughter, is good with chopsticks. And then you're off to the races. That's it. And I remember we started the scene.
Do they tell you you should be insulted by that or whatever? Or it's just implied.
I think it's just
So they want you to come back at them. And
they want you to come back at them. And yeah. I think they want, I mean, you look at how contentious that show is for the most part. Yeah. And, you know, we're all sort of, everybody is the voice of reason. Except. Everyone is straight manning Larry pretty much. And you still get your jokes in, no question. But, but you are the audience's proxy, and when the audience sees Larry do something inappropriate, they expect you to step up for them.
Right.
So I remember we started the scene, and my wife goes to the famously skittish Larry David, Larry, and hugs him. And I was like, great, Jamie, you've cost us this. You've straight up cost us this. Hugs Larry David, who's not a hugger.
As part of the audition.
As part of the audition.
And by the way, there's an unwritten rule in auditioning for anything. You generally don't touch the casting people or the reader. Even if it says shake hands, you just mime shaking hands.
My wife is a monster professional. It was really weird. But then, you know, after that, we were getting big laughs. We made Jeff laugh. We cracked up Larry in the middle of the audition, and that was a good sign. Then we got the job later that after. I actually ran into Jeff Garland that night. He was like, "Yeah, you got it. You're all set. We'll see you next week."
Wow.
And it is, you know, Larry's not a mean guy. Yeah. Larry's not an unpleasant guy. He just, you know, sticks to himself.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he wants to talk. You know, if you want to talk about sports, maybe you can talk a little sports with him. The three guys who were running it were Dave Mandel, Alec Bird, and Jeff Schaefer, who've all gone on to run Veep and Silicon Valley and The League, respectively. So it's, you know, real, there were super comedy chops over there.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing thing, you know, just being given that amount of freedom during an audition is so fun. Reno was the same thing. Reno, you came in with your idea. Reno, you were like, all right, so here's what you need to know. We're at the Reno Renaissance Fair, and we're trying to report a stolen vehicle, and that's all you need to know. And you would basically tell them what the premise was, and then you'd get up and riff that. And that was a total delight as well. Yeah, there was a lovely little golden age in the aughts where there was all this improvised TV.
Yeah. And then when you actually shot Reno, it was the same way. They give you sort of a rough outline of what the scene is and where you have to end up. And
boom. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, what's your objective and where are you going to wrap it up? And then they'd end up cutting wherever they ended up cutting. But it was really fun, especially on Reno, where it was not a really super story-based thing. Take off on Cops.
Yeah.
So it was these little vignettes.
Yeah. Strung together.
So it was a really, Reno was a party. And also, once you shot, you were there for 3 hours on the outside. They got you in and out of there super quick.
Because
they shot it documentary style, and you'd go to some mall in Tarzana, and that was a hike, but then you'd bang it out, have lunch with some of the funniest people in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
That's great. Speechless, second season coming up. You'll see, John Ross Bowie on stage accepting the Emmy. Hopefully he'll just a shout out to me if, you know, he feels up to it.
If it happens, you have my word.
You know what I would like? Maybe you could give me a perfect tag for my Last Supper joke from the Emmy stage.
That would be amazing.
Just one more thing. Paul, I think this would be
your closer on that one is...
Hey, thanks for doing this. It's great to see you in person, meet you in person. I've always really admired your work.
And I yours.
I think you've
this
got a really
fun.
Cool... really, really cool body of work, and the stuff that you do when you
do it
is very unique and very you. Like, there's only one you.
Oh, I appreciate
that.
So, really great.
Even the commercials, like, you're just, you know. So I was really happy to see you in the show in sort of a lead capacity. So watch the show, and watch him get the Emmy, and we'll see you guys next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.